Up next on Tech Nation, Dr. Moira Gunn speaks with Kim Stanley Robinson, the author of the Mars Trilogy. In his latest book, 50 Degrees Below, he surmises what it would be like if the Gulf Stream stopped flowing. From IT Conversations. Hello, this is Doug Kay, the executive producer of IT Conversations, and today I'm excited to bring you another edition of Tech Nation with Dr. Moira Gunn. IT Conversations is underwritten by listener donations. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, the content delivery network for online broadcasts, music, movies, and software downloads, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at www.limelightnetworks.com. And now, here's the host of Tech Nation, Dr. Moira Gunn.
You likely know Kim Stanley Robinson best as the author of the Mars Trilogy. Now he's in the middle of another trilogy. In his latest one, he projects the consequence of global warming, that the Gulf Stream would stop in its tracks.
Well, it's part of a world current that is amazingly big in that it starts in the Indian Ocean, goes into the Atlantic, goes all the way up the Atlantic from down at the bottom, and then in the far North Atlantic, it has transferred the heat from the tropics up to the North Atlantic, and this is, I'm told, a petawatt per year, which, you know, people say...
What's a petawatt?
Yeah. Well, it's 100 times the amount that all human energy generation is. So it's a lot. And that much heat is transferred about 10 or 15 degrees latitude north, further than it would be otherwise. And that's why Europe is warm, and that's why Norway is relatively warm, and that's why when we go to Europe, we're thinking, well, it's just like us, and not noticing that in Europe is 10 degrees further north than we are. So then it sinks to the bottom. It cools, it sinks, and it goes south on the bottom. So the whole thing is like a giant conveyor belt. And the problem is that it can stall on the surface and not sink to the bottom if it isn't salty enough. So if it gets fresher because of melted ice, then...
From global warming.
From global warming, off of the Arctic sea ice and the Greenland ice cap. That pours in... They reckon that since 1960, about 30 to 50% more fresh water has poured onto the surface of the North Atlantic than used to because of global warming. And they don't really know when this might stall the system, which would mean that the salty, warm water would plunge to the bottom maybe 1,000 or 1,500 miles further south, and Europe would be in terrible trouble. They don't know exactly what would how much would precipitate that, but they've got parameters because it's pretty straightforward physics. It's actually easier than atmospheric calculations because they don't have to calculate clouds. So ocean is a little bit simpler than atmosphere. And they've got it pegged to, they say, well, there's a 50% chance it'll happen in the next 100 years. Well, this is very high. This is the possibilities are very high. And if the Gulf Stream stalls, Europe is in terrible trouble, and world weather can change within a period of like 3 years. So that's why they coined this phrase, abrupt climate change. And this I found very amusing because, you know, geologists, when you used to ask them, you know, is this fast? And they'd say, yes, this is fast. And you say, how fast? And they'd say, well, maybe 10,000 years, really fast. So they were like Peter crying wolf. They could never really convey how fast they meant this time without using the word abrupt. And they can't say instantaneous, but in geological scales, it's almost instantaneous. And this is a paradigm shift. Climatologists 10 years ago wouldn't have conceded that weather, global systems, could change that rapidly.
But we have hard science that shows it happened before.
Yes, that's exactly right. The Younger Dryas of about 11,000 to 8,000 years ago is where they've seen this 3 years. In the Greenland ice coring data, they have seen the three-year shift, and it's really quite solid. Most scientists who study this are in agreement. Yeah, it can happen overnight or, say, 3 years. And so the Gulf Stream stall is the thing that has been pegged as the thing that can make this happen so fast. If that amount of heat is not being carried north in the Atlantic, the whole northern hemisphere changes and goes from warm and wet, which is what we have now, to cold, dry, windy, which is what they had in the Ice Age. So when I read about this just a few years ago, when it was first being talked about, I thought, as a science fiction writer, well, this is good. And even as a citizen of the world, I'm thinking maybe this is good. As a novelist, it's obvious. You know, if something happens in 3 years rather than in 500 years, you're better off in trying to figure out a story of how human beings are impacted, and you can just frame a story better. And I had been interested in global warming, but I hadn't figured out a story to tell until I heard about abrupt climate change. And then as a citizen, I was just thinking, you know, our natural tendency is to put off really long-term problems onto the future generations and say, hey, they're going to be clever. They're going to have stronger technology than we do. We've got problems right now we've got to deal with. We'll let the future generations deal with global warming. And if it's 3 degrees warmer 200 years from now, who cares anyway? Maybe it won't be so bad and blah, blah. And I think everybody is almost justified in that mindset, to tell you the truth. But if it's going to happen in 3 years, if it could happen in the next 50 years, if it could be our children who are dealing with a really thrashed environment from this weather and climate change, then we may be forced to deal with these problems that we should have been dealing with all along, but now a little fire is lit under us.
What do you have happen to Washington, D.C. in your novel?
Well, apparently the eastern half of North America is also strongly affected by this possible climate
stalling,
change.
If you will.
Yeah, the stall of the Gulf Stream. And so Washington, D.C. is kind of on the bubble there, but in essence, what you would have is kind of Arctic winds coming straight down North America instead of shooting out over the Atlantic. And so they predict that the weather would get very uncertain and variable, so that you might still have the swampy, jungle-like, tropical situation in D.C. during the summer, and yet during the winter you might have it be like Buffalo or like Toronto or like the Yukon Territory for a period of a month at a time. And, you know, I don't know if you've lived in the East Coast like I have, but the D.C. area is not built to keep people warm in situations like that. There would be a serious crisis if we had winters that severe that far south. So it all added up to a science fiction novel. To my mind, I mean, this is what I'm looking for when I look at the current news, is these interesting and dramatic tipping points or crux moments, places where we get stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Certainly in the summer, it would be lots of water, lots of swamp, lots of what we would call flooding from normal. You wrote this before Hurricane Katrina hit, and it's as if it happened to Washington.
Yeah. It's a little creepy. That was not a particularly hard call to make, but of course you can make calls like that. You know, you could say, we're going to have a big earthquake here in the Bay Area, and you know it is true. But to write it in a book, to imagine it happening in a book, and then to have it happen the next year rather than 50 years later.
And to have this actual current event in which one could see a major city be taken out by major flooding.
Yes. Yes, it was. It's a little creepy. I mean, I'd be happier if it wasn't, if New Orleans was still there and in good health, obviously.
But we could see a high water mark on the Washington Monument.
Yeah, we could. The Mall in Washington, D.C. is only 10 feet above sea level. And this is something that I'm constantly amazed at, because it's about 90 miles inland, but it's a swamp. It's very low-lying for a long ways, and it's a big watershed, something like 14,000 square miles. If you had a really big hurricane-like dumping of rain, or had like that perfect storm that wonderful book was written about, where an Arctic storm hits a hurricane together in the mid-Atlantic states, then you'd be mid-Atlantic. It'd be very wet. So it can happen, and we need to try to be ready for it.
You've been involved with the National Science Foundation. I know they sent you to Antarctica as part of their Antarctica Artists and Writers Program. And NSF plays a big role in your book. Now, let's talk about Frank Valdewald, did I pronounce it correctly?
I don't know. It's a
you wrote it.
Vanderwall, I think.
Yeah, okay.
I think the baseball player of similar name is Vanderwall.
Okay, great. So Vanderwall, and he's a scientist at the National Science Foundation. How does it play out in your book?
Well, I have him as a visiting scientist. You know, NSF staffs their main office in Arlington, Virginia, with academics from all over the United States and the world who come on 1 or 2 year appointments. And my Frank has come from UCSD in San Diego and is a biomathematician with an interest in sociobiology. His interest in sociobiology is perhaps personal, a little bit too intense, in that he tries to live by it, and this leads to a lot of comedy of disaster, you might say, personal disaster. But He's working on this issue of if the Gulf Stream were to stall, if we are clearly on the edge of global warming, can science rally itself and become a coherent working force and influence policy, influence government politics, and the way that we live our lives? Could we, by living a more scientific life in the, both individuals and as a society, could we come to grips with this problem and even solve it? It's the question that I'm trying to explore in these novels. And so Frank is a kind of a comic character because he's trying to do too much and he's trying to arrange his romantic life as well in these novels. Among and many other things, I think of them as romantic comedies or utopian black comedy, I've been calling them. Nobody knows what that is, but that's what these books are trying to explore or invent. So NSF is interested in these books. I mean, the people working there, they're, of course, happy to have NSF suddenly portrayed in a novel because nobody pays attention to either NSF or science in general in most novels about America today. Even though our lives are completely determined by science, you could read 100 novels and not have even one of them talk about the scientific basis for society. So that, you know, when Tom Wolfe made his famous manifesto that the novel has to take on all of society like it used to back in the days of Balzac and Dickens. I'm on board with that. I love that notion, and I think he's made a good try at it. But you have to go further than the superficial surface of things. You have to actually try to go down into the infrastructure and see why society is built the way it is, and that means you get back to science and technology because everything that we do now is framed by that. We simply are living in a science fiction novel, so we better start reading and writing them.
The National Science Foundation definitely comes into play, and that those are the people we would call as sort of the center to say, how do we get this Gulf Stream started up again? What is it in your book, and where does that play out in sort of the complement of possibilities for how we might get it started up again?
Well, that, this is a good question because it allows me to talk about what we might be able to do in terms of interventions in the global atmosphere and also things that we can't do. The reason that I got interested in this Gulf Stream is not only that things happen fast, but also it's one of the very few giant global systems that we could imagine intervening with and doing what in my Mars books I called terraforming. We end up having to terraform Earth, which is, still strikes me funny. But and we already are terraforming Earth. That's what global warming is. It's just that we're doing it in ignorance and doing it badly, and it's harming the Earth. But we could actually conceptualize it as global systems management and try to get ourselves back to homeostasis and to biosphere health. But there's some things we could within the capacities of industrial society and some things not. I thought, and I consulted with some oceanographers on this, that if you essentially drafted about one-third of the oil tankers on Earth and filled them with salt, which is about 2 or 3 years of the world's production of salt, but there's lots of salt waiting there to be put to use. You could run a little trail like leaving crumbs behind in the woods of salty water that would entrain the Gulf Stream to lead it back north again. And for at least one season, you could maybe lead the Gulf Stream back north again by salting the ocean. It struck me funny, and it struck me as a kind of a science fiction big picture novel that could yet be happening even 20 years from now. It's physically possible, which is the kind of science fiction that I like. Now, I portray that as happening, and in the third volume, you know, we'll find out whether it really works or not. But the point I'd want to add to this is that not every change that we're making is amenable to being corrected like this. The ocean, for instance, is being acidified by global warming, and this is something that has been underreported and not really fully studied yet. All that carbon that's going up in the atmosphere, a fair amount of it, like 6 billion tons per year, is being taken up by the oceans, and carbon in the ocean tends to acidify the oceans, and the pH changes towards acid, and that the littlest creatures in the ocean have calcium shells, tiny, fragile, minuscule calcium shells that might not be capable of forming in a more acid ocean water. And they are the base of the food chain, and everybody knows how food chains work, and we're at the top of that food chain. My point is, you cannot deacidify the ocean by any industrial process that you can imagine. They've even calculated this in the Royal Society in England. They've run the numbers in a very scientific way, which there's something basically comic about the way that scientists attempt to make everything quantitative. But they've decided that if you took out the White Cliffs of Dover and all the rest of the limestone in Great Britain, which is a stupendous amount, and of course you'd be burning carbon to do it, and dumped it all into the ocean, you know, ground fine so that it would make the ocean more base, it still wouldn't work. So, an impossible thing, and yet we don't want the oceans to get more acid because it's quite dangerous, and so we have to stop putting carbon into the atmosphere. And so this is one of those new, rather shocking prohibitions. It's not just that the temperature is going to be 2 degrees higher some places on Earth 200 years from now. It's more immediate and more dangerous than we thought.
About your last book, 40 Signs of Rain, which was the first book in the trilogy, the Washington Post wrote, shows us the dysfunctional intersection of science and politics. Is it any better in this book?
Well, they are working on it. It becomes an interesting question in this book, and this is a political novel. It's one of those novels that does try to encompass the whole of our lives, and it's a Washington, D.C. novel, so it sort of has to be political. The thesis of the novel, and it's a belief that I hold, is that science has been set aside out of policy decisions in a way that is inappropriate and is almost a category error. It comes from the end of World War II, when Truman and his people were, in essence, kind of scared of those guys in their white lab coats with their glasses and their slide rules, because they had just won World War II by mysterious means between radar, penicillin, and the atom bomb, most emphatically. They had won the war by going into their labs and coming out and saying the problem's solved. Well, this was a little spooky, and it looked like they might even take over the world politically, that they might
want
to...
A lot of science fiction books were written.
Yeah.
Proposing such a thing.
So the first National Science Foundation bill to Congress was vetoed by Truman, because the scientists themselves got to choose who ran NSF, and he wanted to make the choices. So the Congress revised the bill, and so the president chooses the National Science Board members and the director. And then we feel like we're in political control of science in the same way that we're in political control of our military. Supposedly, you know, the Pentagon wouldn't do anything without civilian orders. Well, science
all the secretaries of the Air Force and the Army, those are all civilians.
Yes, exactly. And then so the military is under civilian control. Great idea. And I hope it always stays that way. But to think of science as being under, quote, civilian control is a kind of category error, because science is not quite the same as the military. Science can be, and often, and I'd say usually is, a kind of utopian attempt to make things better on this earth, not only for human beings, or even if it's only for human beings, it implicates everything else. You have to have a healthy biosphere to have healthy people. So I'm thinking that science has to take a more prominent role, and you see it happening. The NAS and the Royal Society in England,
NAS is?
The National Academy of Sciences. The various scientific organizations are beginning to get a little bit more strident and say, wait a second, we have to say to you all making policy decisions that you really need to do this, because we can tell you that as far as science can see the future, which isn't very well, but it's better than nothing, we have serious problems that they simply must be addressed. And you can see Tony Blair reacting to, say, this white paper from the Royal Society. And there's like 134 scientific organizations that have signed a statement together as kind of the world scientific uber body, that that we need to come to immediate grips with the problem of burning carbon. And so you sort of see this happening already. In my novel, I try to show NSF, which is really a tiny little mammal amongst the dinosaurs in Washington, D.C., so much so that they're a little bit nervous at me portraying them as the hero of a novel, because they're saying, well, wait, we're so small. Why put this on us, Stan? We can't do this. But I'm using them symbolically, because they stand for science, and they stand for the United States' commitment to science. And so they may indeed be the right place to at least coordinate these efforts or to talk about these efforts. This is what I'm kind of exploring and trying to tell the story of in these novels. So they are utopian novels, and they are talking not just about big issues or about salting the ocean to make the Gulf Stream come back, but also changing the way that we look at how we live, to kind of downshift in our energy consumption and get a higher quality result out of it.
Well, as you've said, as advertised, this is a trilogy. When can we expect the third and final installment?
It'll be the spring of 2007 or so. And I must say to my readers and your listeners that it's I appreciate people reading these books while the story's not yet done. It's not an uncommon thing in literature, and I think everybody knows the stories of Charles Dickens, you know, scurrying to finish chapters of a book that everybody was already hooked on, and it would come out in monthly installments. And this is sort of the modern version of that. I mean, it is a single story. It harkens back to my earlier novel, Antarctica, in a way, and it might be one of these sequences that I come back to from time to time in my life. But this part of the story is not yet done. I think that people could enjoy these books, reading them right now, and not be too irritated at the cliffhangers that I end each volume with. And it'll all be done in spring of 2007.
Well, we expect to see you back here. We want to know how it ends.
It'll end well, just like history, I hope.
Just like a romance novel.
Well, exactly. I like those kinds of endings, and I think we all deserve them.
Well, Kim, thanks so much. My guest today is Kim Stanley Robinson. His latest book is 50 Degrees Below. It's published by Bantam.
You've been listening to the IT Conversations podcast edition of Tech Nation with Moira Gunn. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, the content delivery network for online broadcasts, music, movies, and software downloads, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at www.limelightnetworks.com. IT Conversations is listener-supported, so please contribute to our tip jar. 100% of your donation will go to our team of volunteers who produce these programs for you in their spare time. Most editions of Tech Nation are recorded at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation is also available on over 200 public radio stations throughout the United States, as well as Armed Forces Radio. Please check your local listings for time and availability. The post-production audio engineer for the IT Conversations podcast edition of Tech Nation is Paul Figiani. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of Tech Nation here on IT Conversations.